Welcome to Wise Counsel, a podcast interview series sponsored by MentalHelp.net, covering topics in mental health, wellness, and psychotherapy. My name is Dr. David Van Nuys. I'm a clinical psychologist and your host. On today's show, we'll be talking about schema therapy with Dr. Jeffrey Young. Dr. Jeffrey Young is founder and director of the Cognitive Therapy Centers of New York and Connecticut and the Schema Therapy Institute. He's also on the faculty in the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. He received his undergraduate training at Yale University and his graduate degree at the University of Pennsylvania. He then completed a postdoctoral fellowship at the Center for Cognitive Therapy at the University of Pennsylvania with Dr. Aaron Beck and went on to serve there as Director of Research and Training. Dr. Young has lectured on cognitive and schema therapies internationally for the past 24 years, and he's trained thousands of mental health professionals and is widely acclaimed for his outstanding teaching skills. He's the founder of Schema Therapy, an integrative approach for personality disorders and treatment-resistant patients. He's published widely in the fields of both cognitive and schema therapies, including two major books, Schema Therapy, A Practitioner's Guide, written for mental health professionals, and Reinventing Your Life, a popular self-help book based on schema therapy. So, now let's get into the interview. Dr. Jeffrey Young, welcome to the Wise Counsel podcast.
Thank you.
You're founder and director of the Schema Therapy Institute in New York. What is schema therapy?
Well, schema therapy is a therapy that's an expansion of cognitive therapy, and I started developing it in the, let's say, mid-1980s, and it's a therapy designed to work with long-standing, lifelong problems using a more active and directive approach, structured approach. So in my way of looking at it, it sort of combines the benefits of many other approaches. So it has the kind of active, structured nature of cognitive therapy, but it goes much deeper than cognitive therapy usually does, in the same way that you might, for example, in psychoanalysis, dealing with early childhood problems and early themes that develop when you were very young in life. So it's kind of has both depth to it because it's designed to work with these deep-rooted problems, but it also does it in a very practical and active way.
Well, that's very interesting because in a way, the psychotherapy world was split in half for a long time with the psychodynamic camp on one side and the behavioral camp on the other side. So it sounds like you made an attempt here to really integrate the two.
Yes, and although originally it wasn't my conscious intention to do that, but what I was trying to do originally was I was noticing that I was originally trained by Aaron Beck, the developer of cognitive therapy. I was one of his first students. And so I was doing cognitive therapy with depressed patients at his clinic in a research study, and, you know, it was extremely effective with when you have a research study when you have people who are depressed, but they've been screened out because they don't have other problems like personality disorders. But then when I went into private practice, I started discovering that when you don't have a well-screened research study, you have patients with much more complex problems than we were getting in our research project. And I realized that for the patients who had lifelong problems, I had to add something to cognitive therapy in order for it to be effective with these lifelong kinds of problems. So I started looking other places to get ideas for things that I might want to add in that would deepen the therapy and allow me to work with them. And I found that there were many psychodynamic concepts that were helpful. Also, there were many aspects of Gestalt therapy that were helpful and attachment theory. And I drew from those different elements to try to create an integrated therapy that would have the advantages of all of those. So while it was never a conscious attempt to bridge the gap, I think that's how people now see it, as a kind of a therapy that, you know, if an analyst hears it, an analyst will say, well, there's lots in here that's similar to what I do, but there's a lot that's different. And that's just what a cognitive therapist would say. So, you know, therapists from both approaches can be comfortable with it because there are elements of both approaches in the model.
Okay, now my guess is that most of our listeners will not be therapists, so we might need to back up and simplify some of these terms.
Oh, sure.
So, for example, maybe you could kind of briefly characterize what we mean when we say psychodynamic versus what
sure.
we mean when we say cognitive behavioral versus gestalt therapy.
Sure. I'll describe the different, a little bit about each one of them.
Right.
Basically, the earliest therapy, of course, was Freudian therapy. And Freud's approach came to be called psychoanalysis, or as it's sometimes called more recently, psychodynamic psychotherapy, which is like psychoanalysis, except that in the original psychoanalysis, as Freud did it, the patient would lie on a sofa and come in, you know, with back to the therapist and would, you know, come in four times a week and get psychotherapy. Now, the way psychoanalysis is currently practiced in what's called psychodynamic therapy, many of the same principles from Freud are still part of psychoanalysis, but now the therapist will face the patient, look, you know, instead of looking with their back to the therapist, the patient therapist look at each other face to face, and they only come in once a week or twice a week. So, in that sense, it's deviated from the way it originally started with Freudian therapy. But what I think in everyday language, I'd say what psychoanalysis is, whether the original or the newer versions of it, is trying to look at people's childhood experiences and trying to get patients to have insight into their childhood with the hope that the insight alone, for the most part, will be enough to cure their current problems. They also believe that the therapy relationship is one in which the therapist can show the patient how they're kind of acting out the same problems they had with their parents are now being played out with the therapist, and if the therapist can point out how they do that and give them insight into how they're replaying their childhood in the therapy, then the patient will again gain insight into it, and the insight alone will be enough for them to get better. So that's psychodynamic therapy. And the problem, the reason that cognitive therapy developed was because one of the main people was Aaron Beck, who developed cognitive therapy, and he had been trained as an analyst. And he felt that the psychoanalytic approach, first of all, insight probably was not enough to, for example, get someone out of a depression. And he felt that they needed to do more than that, and also perhaps that psychoanalysis was too convoluted. It had very complex explanations for things that were actually much simpler. For example, a psychoanalyst believes that depression is anger turned inward, or anger turned against the self.
Yes.
But when Beck actually studied depression, he found that anger was simply having a negative view of oneself, a negative view of the world, a negative view of the future. And most of the time, it wasn't actually anger at other people turned toward oneself. It was simply a very negative view of pretty much everything.
Depression.
So,
yes.
What's that?
You're describing depression. That was his view of depression, that it was
right. And
a negative outlook.
That's an example, though, of an area where he felt that the Freudian way of approaching and understanding it was not right.
Mm-hmm.
And then he developed cognitive therapy, which simply said, let's look at what the patient's thinking when they're in particular situations, and look at the way in which depressed people, for example, distort or they misinterpret what's happening in their life. So if a depressed person, for example, is looking at maybe, let's say, someone walks by them and doesn't say hello, instead of being able to say, well, maybe the person didn't notice me, the depressed person thinks, oh, they hate me, I'm a terrible person, no wonder they didn't talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
So the depressed person interprets events in a very negative way. And Beck's idea was to help patients see how they're interpreting events in a way that's negative, and to help them see a more realistic and objectively accurate way of looking at what was happening. And by doing this in one situation after another and teaching the patient how to correct their own negative thinking, the patient would gradually be able to come out of the depression. But it was very different, and so it's very active and very focused on what's happening right now. You take a situation in the patient's current life, see how they're examining it, try to help the patient see is it realistic or not, and then give them suggestions of ways to change how they're viewing it. Unlike psychoanalysis, where, again, it could take years to try to get someone to gain insight into the childhood origins of their depression.
Well, what was the good part of psychoanalysis that you brought in? Because you do say that you utilize some elements.
Yes, well, I think the mistake in psychoanalysis was to believe that looking at the origins of a child's origins of the patient's problem was enough to get somebody better. And you know, the basic idea in psychoanalysis is that insight is the solution to psychological problems. And what I feel is that it is, in fact, very helpful for people with long-term problems to know the origins. And it is very helpful to work on their problems when they come up in the therapy relationship, but that isn't enough. So I think what I took from it was what I took from it was the idea that it was important to look at a child who was which cognitive therapy, because it was sort of a rebellion against psychoanalysis, cognitive therapy rejected the idea that there was any real value in looking at childhood or looking at where a person's problems came from. If you just looked at the present, that would be enough. And I came to find that with these patients with lifelong problems, it was extremely helpful for them to look at where their problems came from and to understand why do they keep getting, for example, in these self-defeating patterns? Why do they keep picking selfish partners? Why do they keep why is their anger out of control and they can't seem to understand why am I acting this way? So having insight into why was very helpful, but it wasn't enough, but it is very valuable.
Okay,
but
well,
that's just one example.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. So that you do like to explore the history and where the problems originate and how they developed, but then the behavior therapy adds a second sort of practical, concrete steps to then move towards change. And you also imported some pieces from Gestalt therapy, so maybe you could say a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, Gestalt therapy was developed by Fritz Perls, Perls. And Gestalt therapy really is quite very different from both cognitive and psychodynamic therapy in that, without going into the theory behind it, but much of the therapy involves doing exercises such as imagery exercises or dialogues between two parts of the self, when you move back and forth between two chairs, but they're exercises designed to stir up emotions and to get the patient in touch with emotions that they've blocked out.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole idea of using imagery of doing things that bypass conscious thinking. The idea here is that, you know, just talking rationally and logically about something won't change it as well as getting the person to emotionally feel whatever it is that's bothering them. And if they can get fully, the idea of Gestalt therapy is if you can fully understand and get in touch with all of your feelings, you will then get better. Now, again, it had the same problem as the other two therapies, which is that alone I found wasn't enough, but it was extremely useful for patients to be able to learn to practice things like imagery. I'll have them close their eyes, picture themselves, for example, as a child with their parent in which they're having something upsetting, some upsetting memory from their childhood. And in doing so, that stirs up the feelings of whether it's inadequacy, anger, shame, guilt, and in a way that talking about it never can do. So I found that the use of these Gestalt techniques, such as imagery, was really invaluable. But again, no one of these approaches was enough by itself. And that's why I felt that integrating, in a sense, the imagery and other emotion-focused techniques from Gestalt therapy looking at childhood and therapy relationship, as we did doing psychoanalysis, combined with focusing on practical solutions to present problems, as we do in cognitive behavior therapy, that putting them all together came up with a very powerful approach.
Yeah, very good. I think most therapists these days, or certainly a great many, describe themselves as eclectic and draw on different therapeutic currents. But you've kind of systematized this and given it a kind of structure and coherence that, from what I read on your website, really makes a lot of sense.
Yes, I think that is a difference between eclectic therapy and schema therapy, is that in eclectic therapy, the therapist is open to trying many different approaches, but they don't actually integrate them, meaning they don't have a model for how to blend the different approaches together in a systematic way. So, for example, they might start with cognitive therapy, and then if that doesn't work, they simply switch to Gestalt therapy techniques. If that doesn't work, they'll switch to psychodynamic approaches. But there's no conceptual model, no theory that unifies the different parts of the therapy, whereas in schema therapy, we have a whole model based on the idea of schemas that draws together the different elements of these other therapies. So it's not just a sort of hit and miss trial and error thing, but more you have a systematic rationale for why you first use this technique and then you blend it with this technique, but in a much more systematic way.
Yes, I was impressed by that as I went through your site. Although the name schema sounds a little technical, and it communicates to me as a psychologist, to the average person out there who's, you know, looking for some therapy, I'm not sure what that would communicate to them. Do you have any sense of that?
Well, it's the same problem as sort of cognitive. I mean, until people learned what it was, no one knew what the word cognitive was. Originally, when we were doing cognitive therapy,
right,
people said, what's cognitive mean? So it's a similar thing. But schema, in the way I presented in the self-help book, Reinventing Your Life, that I wrote with Janet Glasgow, we actually call them life traps, which is more understandable for someone who's not a therapist. And so maybe I'll explain it more that way because I think it's easier to grasp it that way.
Yeah, so great. That was the very next thing on my list here, because I noticed that on your website, which is full of very rich material, and I'll give people that web address before we're done. So, yeah, go ahead. Tell us about the life traps.
Yeah, what I was going to say is that a life trap or a schema, whichever word you prefer to use, it's basically a life theme or a life pattern. And we tried to find out what are the most common life themes, life patterns that people have in their lives that tend to repeat themselves from childhood on and that keep getting us in trouble. And then we've given names to these individual life traps. So, for example, we have one called abandonment life trap, or the abandonment schema.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the feeling, the sense that you have that whoever you're with, whoever you're close to, is going to leave you at any time. And so it's the sort of anxiety all the time that whoever, let's say if you're in a relationship, that your partner is going to find someone else and leave you.
Sure.
Or that they're going to die and leave you. But you're always worried that all the time that whoever you're with is going to somehow abandon you.
Sure.
And usually it starts out because one of the parents abandoned the child. Perhaps there was a divorce and the parent just left the home and never had any contact anymore. In some instances, you have parents who would leave the child for like hours at a time in their crib at a very young age and would never come when the child would cry. But these early life experiences of having people either not there or kind of they're there, but then they just disappear. It's scary to a child. They develop this pattern, which we call abandonment, which makes them sensitive throughout their life to this whole theme of people abandoning them. And even when people aren't abandoning them, they feel as if people are.
Okay.
So someone with an abandonment schema, for example, would if anything that their partner does that might suggest that maybe they have somebody else in their life. Let's say, for example, that they a husband finds his wife is on the phone talking to another man. Rather than asking who the man is, he just assumes that the man is some threat to him, and that the man is, the wife's going to leave him for this man on the phone, rather than asking and finding out that the guy on the phone might be her boss, or it could be a friend or something, someone. It's not a threat at all to him.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have abandonment, you're oversensitive to it, and you read it into situations where it doesn't really exist.
Definitely. So what are some of the other dysfunctional patterns that you refer to as life traps?
Sure. Well, we have 18 of them that we've identified. It's taken us 20 years to define these 18.
And wow.
We think these probably capture most all of the main life themes that
wow.
people have that start early in life. Although in the book, Reinventing Your Life, we only have 11 of them because basically they didn't want the book to be that long. So we picked the 11 most common ones. So, but some of the other common ones, I'll just name a few, are, for example, defectiveness, which is the feeling that you're basically unlovable or something that if people really got to know you, they would reject you or would never stay with you. Another one called mistrust abuse, which is the sense of not trusting people, that people are going to try to hurt you, they're going to try to humiliate you or put you down or cheat you or take advantage of you. That would be a mistrust schema. One called unrelenting standards, which is the sense that you have to do almost everything almost perfectly. So it's a kind mm-hmm. of a perfectionism.
Sure.
And for someone with this life pattern, they're constantly under pressure to do almost everything almost perfectly. So it's very hard for them to relax and enjoy life because they're always trying to do everything perfectly, and it drains them.
You know, these
those are a few of them. We have many more, but
yeah.
those are some of the common ones.
You know, these patterns, the way you describe them, they're instantly recognizable. I mean, I think we would all, I certainly can think of, see elements in myself or people that I know that or have known that fit the patterns you're describing. And the terminology feels a lot less blaming than the diagnostic and statistical manual, the way it describes disorders. I like your approach better.
Well, I appreciate that. And we actually often will say that to, when therapists will say, well, why use this list of themes? I say, well, one difference is it's a lot that a client feels much better being told that they have an abandonment issue, which is, and that they're, you know, they're sensitive to being abandoned, than they do being labeled hysteric or borderline personality disorder. It fits better with what people actually feel, and it doesn't have that sort of pejorative label that these other diagnoses have.
Yeah, exactly.
And as you say, most patients, when they even just read the list with a one-sentence definition, can even, most people, not just patients, but people in general, when they read the list, they can usually see at least four or five of them that easily apply them. So it's not even hard for someone, it's not like you have to go through, you know, months of work to help someone recognize these themes. They're immediately understandable to most people.
Yeah.
So it also is a good way of teaching people about lifelong issues because the concepts are easy to grasp.
Mm-hmm. I was interested to see that forgiveness is an important step in the process. And I've been reading about forgiveness recently, and I know there's been some very interesting research on the power of forgiveness. Can you comment on that?
Yes, well, actually, we added this on as one of the later parts of the therapy, adding forgiveness, because what we were finding was that an important part of the therapy, as I mentioned, was looking at origins. And many, many clients, and not just clients, I'll use clients, but I think it's true of most people in general, but, you know, when you start looking at where you develop lifelong problems, very often they do go back to things in your childhood related to your parents. And we were finding that a lot of patients were, as they came to understand the things their parents did that were wrong and how those hurt them, they would start to be angry at the parents and resentful toward them for having made these mistakes when they were young. And we realized that while that was an important step in the therapy to recognize that, you know, that it's not my fault, if, for example, it's not for a client to realize it's not their fault that they keep, for example, putting themselves down all the time, that in fact that's what their parent did, and they're simply doing to themselves what was done to them early in life. But once they get better and they learn how to stop doing that to themselves, and then then we feel it's important for them to learn to be able to forgive the parent, because of course the parent in most cases didn't intentionally hurt the child. They did it, they did the best they could. They just weren't perfect parents. So we decided that forgiveness was very important, or else our patients by the end of therapy were leaving feeling better in terms of with their own problem. Their life problems had been solved or pretty much solved, but they left angry at their parents and going around with a lot of resentment and anger about what had happened in their past. And we realized that really wasn't healthy either. So we started working on helping clients at the end of therapy to begin to sort of look at the clients, at the parents' own life traps. That it's not just the patient has life traps, but so does the parent. And if you can understand that the parent had their own life issues and their own life patterns, and that's why they did many of the things they did, you can be more sympathetic and understanding and forgive them for the things they did instead of resenting them and continuing to be angry at them.
Right. And what about self-forgiveness? Isn't that an important dimension as well?
Yeah, although when we put it in the book, we're referring really to forgiving other people. But yes, I mean, forgiveness is central to many of these life traps, because many of them do involve blaming oneself, being critical of oneself, defectiveness, unrelenting standards. Many of these, punitiveness, many of these involve various ways in which we're hard on ourselves, blame ourselves, and are not forgiving. We've learned to teach people to be forgiving of themselves when they make mistakes instead of beating up on themselves all the time. For people who have that life trap, it's a very important step.
Okay. So who needs schema therapy? What kinds of cases is it best suited for?
Well, now we're talking about for a point of view of, from the perspective of the therapist because many people who aren't even patients, for example, we've had amazing numbers of people who read Reinventing Your Life and say that, you know, they weren't a client, they didn't have serious mental health problems like depression or things, and yet they found they could benefit a lot from schema therapy or the ideas in schema therapy. So I think that if you ask me the honest truth, I think the majority of people probably would actually benefit from some schema work, okay, in which they came to understand what their lifelong patterns were, how they keep playing themselves out, and learning how to control them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and how to heal these schemas. So I think that it's appropriate for most people. But now if you ask more from the therapy point of view, for a therapist, you know, who is the patient who comes into therapy who you'd most want to think of as being appropriate for schema therapy? I would basically say any client who comes in where their problem dates back to earlier in their life. Anyone who's had psychological issues or problems since they were, you know, teenagers or children, even if the problems might not have shown themselves till they were older than that, if the origin of the problems start relatively early in life, then schema therapy is likely to be helpful. In particular, this is true of relationship problems. People who keep getting in, repeating negative patterns over and over again in the same kinds of relationships. So partners people who can't be intimate in relationships, or people with anger problems, or people who can't trust other people, or people who keep putting themselves down in relationships. So I think anyone who has consistent problems in across relationships is usually a very good candidate for, you know, for schema therapy.
You mentioned people with problems in relationships, and that makes me wonder if you have any sort of an approach for working with couples.
But that's also one of our newer aspects of the therapy is actually developing. We've developed a model for using schema therapy in couples,
mm-hmm,
which involves trying to look at which life traps each partner in a couple has, and helping the couple to see how their schemas clash with each other.
Yes.
So as we might say, you might have one partner with a mistrust schema and one partner with, let's say, a deprivation schema. And then what happens is each one triggers the other when they interact with each other. And we'll look at problems or conflict the couples have and try to show the couple how it's because of their schemas clashing that they keep having this conflict over and over again. So that's been one of the most exciting parts of schema therapy recently, has been extending it to work with couples.
Okay, yeah, that does sound like a very fruitful direction to be moving in. Do you have any sense?
One more thing about that, too, is we've been interested in this concept called schema chemistry, which is the idea that people are drawn to partners who trigger their core schemas. And this has been extremely valuable both in working with couples and individuals when we talk about relationships, realizing that people with these schemas are often drawn to just the kinds of partners who are most likely to trigger the schemas. And that explains why so many people, I think, get into relationships with very high chemistry, but unfortunately they end up being unhealthy relationships.
Yes. do you have a sense of the typical length of treatment?
Well, it would vary a lot depending on basically how severe the problem is. If you have somebody who, let's say a very easy patient would be somebody who's relatively high functioning. They have a job, they have a good relationship, either they're married or they're in an intimate relationship, and they function reasonably well in the world, but they have some problems. So, for example, maybe they, trying to give a common example. Well, for example, let's say they have marital conflict where they have arguments all the time, but they don't hit each other or verbally abuse each other. And these are people, and with someone like that, the therapy, let's say you have a couple like a couple that you're seeing in couples therapy, and both of them are kind of like that, relatively high functioning in their lives, but they have particular areas where they have conflicts. That might last maybe 20 sessions or 25 sessions to help a couple like that. But then we take the other extreme, which would be patients with what's called borderline personality disorder. These are people who, they cut themselves, they're chronically suicidal, they're often hospitalized for suicide attempts. These patients could take 3 years in therapy. So there's an extremely wide range from relatively easy patients who would just be a few months to ones who could be a few years. If you ask me on the average, I'd say 9 to 12 months. But again, there's so much variation that it's misleading a little bit.
Okay. Now, where do you see schema therapy going? You mentioned that one of the new directions was marital therapy. As you look down the road, do you see this expanding or going in other directions in the future?
Well, basically, we keep trying to work with disorders that people haven't been that successful treating. So often we deal with very difficult clients. So what I'm always doing basically is looking for various disorders or types of clients where there are not effective therapies that exist right now. Mm-hmm. So that's why we've been working with borderline personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, and very recently we're also, in addition to couples, we're very interested in psychopathic patients, people in criminal settings, because there really are almost no effective treatments for people in criminal who are, let's say, rapists, serial killers, people who are really quite extreme, but they really aren't not good treatments for them. And yet we think that schema therapy, because it does look at early life problems, which most of these people have very severe early problems, we think it might be very promising with them. So we're developing treatment programs and research studies with these types of patients.
Okay, and I gather that you're pretty active in training other therapists in this approach. Is that right?
Yes. Well, as it's begun to catch on in different countries all over the world now, we're setting up different training programs in different countries, actually. We have one in New York that we've just begun. This is the first year of our international training program here in New York. There's one that's starting in Michigan. They're going to be starting in Michigan. We also have ones, we just started an international schema therapy society, which is for therapists all in different countries who are interested in schema therapy. So there'll be training programs. There's already one in Holland. We're going to be setting one up in England and in Sweden and Norway, Germany, so Australia. So there's a, you know, it's quite exciting right now because it is, again, only in the past few years that it's really begun to have really widespread interest like this.
That's great. How about here in the U.S.?
What's that?
How about here in the U.S.?
Well, here in the U.S., it's actually, I would say, again, it's slower to catch on here than in other countries, partly because of our insurance plans. Mm. Because we deal, you know, although I said to you that, you know, there are some cases that we can treat in a few months, the average patient, as I said, is 9 to 12 months. And the trouble is that most insurance plans won't cover patients for longer-term therapy, which when you're dealing with difficult clients or patients with personality disorders, it takes 9 months or a year to treat them. And so a lot of therapists in the U.S. have said, well, this is very interesting, but the clients can't afford, you know, to pay for it. So there is a problem in that there is no real short-term brief treatment for lifelong problems. So, you know, I think that the reason the level of interest has been perhaps less here than in other countries, proportionate to the number of people, is simply because other countries have national health systems where the government will pay for the people to get a year of therapy, whereas that doesn't happen here in our country. So it's part of our, you know, one of the many problems with our mental health insurance system. This is another example of how it lets down people who have actually the most serious problems.
Right. I'm totally in agreement on that. One other thing I noticed on the website was that you've also combined it with mindfulness meditation for those seeking a spiritual approach. How did that come about?
Well, it came about because two friends of mine who are both actually both written books and both been interested, they were both interested in meditation. One is Dan Goleman, who wrote Emotional Intelligence, more recent book, Social Intelligence.
Oh, sure.
And then also his wife, Tara Bennett Goleman, who wrote a book called Emotional Alchemy. And her book, Emotional Alchemy, is a blending of schema therapy with meditation. And the two of them were really the first ones who got interested, to the best of my knowledge, in integrating schema therapy because they themselves have been deeply involved in Buddhist meditation. So they blended many of the techniques from Buddhist mindfulness meditation with schema therapy techniques, and they've been the most active ones in writing, in doing the therapy, and as I said, Tara actually wrote a book, it's actually easy, it's a paperback and widely available, called Emotional Alchemy.
That sounds very interesting. Some of our listeners might want to check that out. Well, let me close things off here with a bit of a whimsical question, which is, if you'd not become a therapist, what other career would have drawn you in?
That's an interesting question. Well, interestingly enough, the other field I was actually interested in, was actually theater and movie directing.
Interesting.
I love theater and I love movies, and early in my life, I'm actually still very interested in theater and movies, but earlier in my life, I had actually thought about, because in a way, being a director, it uses many of the same talents. It's working with people, trying to help get into their characters and understand the, you know, the inner workings of the character that you're portraying or the story that you're telling. So I was very, very interested in that. And I think if I could have been more certain I'd make a predictable income, I might have done that instead. Who knows?
Right, right. Well, how can a listener find a schema therapist in their local area?
Well, the best way would be to send an email or write an email, probably the easiest way, or call our center here in New York. If they send an email to institute@schematherapy.com, we're going to give them the website anyway, so maybe I'll spell schema therapy, and
sure.
Cause that way they can do both the email or the website. It's schematherapy, that's all one word, .com. So they can either go to www.schematherapy.com for our website, or send an email to institute@schematherapy.com, and we'd be happy to give them whatever referrals we have that are closest to them.
That sounds wonderful. Dr. Jeffrey Young, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Wise Counsel.
Well, thank you very much for having me as a guest. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you, Dave.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with my guest, Dr. Jeffrey Young. Schema therapy strikes me as a particularly sensible integration of some time-tested approaches. If you're interested in additional information about schema therapy, I would recommend you explore Dr. Young's site at www.schematherapy.com. There you'll find not only numerous articles and links to other sites, but also a variety of inventories and slideshows. One of the slideshows lists all 18 of the schemas, or life traps, which he alluded to in our conversation. I think his self-help book, Reinventing Your Life, might be a particularly good next step for the interested listener. You've been listening to Wise Counsel, a podcast interview series sponsored by MentalHelp.net. If you found today's show interesting, we encourage you to visit MentalHelp.net, where you can add a comment or question to this show's webpage, view other shows in this series, or simply page through the site, which is full of interesting mental health and wellness content. Access this show's page and show archive information via the podcast box on the MentalHelp.net homepage. If you like Wise Counsel, you might also like Shrink Wrap Radio, my other interview podcast series, which is available online at www.shrinkwrapradio.com, and wrap is spelled R-A-P. Until next time, this is Dr. David Van Nuys, and you've been listening to Wise Counsel.